You're listening to the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, Ben Eagle. To listen to previous episodes, visit thinkingcountry.com or find the podcast on iTunes by searching for Meet the Farmers. Hello and welcome to episode 35 of Meet the Farmers. I'm in Cambridgeshire today and my guest is Georgie Bray, who recently took on the role as farm manager here at the RSPB's Hope Farm. The RSPB bought the 181-hectare arable farm in 2000, and the operations are contracted to a neighbouring farmer. The aim is to farm with both profit and wildlife in mind, and to demonstrate that biodiversity can be boosted on farmland whilst maintaining a profit. Georgie, it's really good to be here.
Hi, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Tell me a bit about yourself and your path to becoming the manager here at the RSPB's farm.
Okay, it's probably slightly unusual for your normal farm manager, but I grew up on a farm and have lived on a farm all my life, which is a small run, sort of 300 acres, very conventional, using quite traditional methods. And I've always had an interest in conservation, as a natural world, so I went and studied zoology and did my master's as well at Nottingham. And during that time I thought, well, hang on a minute, these two don't need to be mutually exclusive parts of my life. Got really interested in conservation within agriculture and found that the RSPB had a lot of jobs within it in that field. Went to being a conservation advisor, and I think I didn't have nearly enough experience for that, so then I applied for the assistant farm manager job here at Hope Farm and was successful, had a fantastic time here for a couple of years, and have now, as the farm manager's moved on, have taken the role of farm manager.
Would you describe yourself as more of a conservationist or a farmer, or do you think that both those labels are actually pointless?
It's really difficult. I always have the worry in my head that to a farmer I'm a conservationist, and then to a conservationist I'm a farmer. But I think as I spend more time in the field, I'm being seen as a proper cross between the two.
Which must be a good thing.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. But it's also, actually, there's quite a lot of farmers who I speak to who are as much of a conservationist as I am as well. I think it's a bit of a niche role in its own.
We got to know each other loosely through the youth organisation called A Focus on Nature, AFON, which, please, listeners, do check it out. Check their website out, A Focus on Nature, which is the youth nature network for under 30s. How did AFON shape you and help you, if at all, in choosing your path and guiding you and helping you to get to where you are now?
I had more of a loose relationship with AFON than you have, but it was...
I'm not entirely sure how my relationship with AFON actually got so serious, but it did.
But it definitely got me in contact with fellow conservationists and yourself as well. I think probably the two main interactions I had with AFON were down in Bristol, with the group down there, where I was doing some work experience with BBC... And Megan said, oh, come along.
This is Megan Shersby.
Yeah, Megan Shersby. Said, oh, come along with some AFON members. You've got a meeting in the pub. And it was just great to talk to fellow conservation folk down there.
Yeah.
I was in the city for a couple of weeks, didn't know anybody down there, and got to chat to lots of like-minded people. And then I managed to speak to a few people when I was applying for jobs as well, who I still haven't met to this day, but they were really helpful, chatting to them on social media. And then, of course, there was the Young Farmers and AFON meeting at the Allerton Project, which was just brilliant. Really good day.
I was really, really pleased with how that went. I think that, for me, AFON is all, and you've alluded to that really well there, it's all about connection and bringing, in that case, young people who are younger people who are interested in wildlife and nature together. That sense of connection within farming, it's a rolling topic within farming, loneliness, isolation, that kind of thing. How many people have you got on this place looking directly and indirectly, and say, obviously with the RSPB link, you've got a really interesting crossover in terms of you're part of a big team, but also a small team at the same time.
Yeah.
But that's not quite common. Tell me about how it works with the RSPB structure. Your team here on the farm, or your role here on the farm, and then your relationship with the RSPB as a whole.
Okay, so it's quite an interesting place in that people permanently working here are me, although it's not normally just me here and myself as it is this morning. Derek, who runs the monitoring program here, Derek Grewer, he does sort of surveying of butterflies and bees and birds and all sorts of other things to do with research projects. And then we've had the recent appointment of Sophie Mott, who is a placement student here from Anglia Ruskin University, and she's with us for a year helping Derek with the research, monitoring and working on her own project. Having said that, we are always having people coming from the lodge, from headquarters, to use this place as either a hub for using the meeting room, having a look around the farm for their own personal development or to check how things are going on. Those people tend to be from the conservation science department looking at the research projects here. The land use policy department, they quite like to bring people from Natural England and DEFRA here to actually show how wildlife friendly farming can work on the ground. And then there's also the advisory group, so that's either from my department or from the regional farming areas where they might bring farmers who are wanting to get interested in wildlife farming here. So whilst it sounds like it could be quite isolated with three people, there are people coming and going all the time, which is really interesting. Yeah. Keeps it varied anyway.
Absolutely. So around 70-75% of UK land area overall is farmed in some way, which obviously from a conservation point of view, the stats there say it all, that if species are moving across a landscape, we have to take note of the farmed area. Do you think from a training and education point of view, conservationists receive enough, I suppose exposure is the word I'll use, exposure to farming and farmers?
Awareness of how important farmland is for wildlife is increasing. Thinking about that, I kind of want to go back on what I said previously about farming and conservation interested people being quite niche, because I don't know if I'm biased being very heavily involved in it, but I feel like that interest group is growing. I think farmland, to people who don't know it, it could be very easily seen as a place for producing food and being quite a barren landscape. But increasingly I'm having actually conservation groups who will go, they'll organise outings to say nature reserves, forests or whatever, where you think would be inherently, well, like the coast, which are inherently biodiverse places. They're actually wanting to come here to see birds.
Yeah.
Which just shows how interesting farmland can be for wildlife. The research around here, I think it's really important that it covers such an expanse of land. And I think it is so interesting because you've got something that is a dual purpose. And that's what a lot of people who are involved in it find interesting as well. It's producing food, but also being a home for diversity. I'm not knocking down nature reserves. I think they're amazing places, but they have the sole purpose for being a home for diversity, which this can sort of do both.
Is this place called Hope Farm or is it called Grange Farm?
Depends who you talk
when
to.
When you Google it as well, it comes up, it comes up as Grange Farm. Did it used to be called Grange Farm before the RSPB took it on?
It's had, in the last couple of hundred years, it's had about three different names. Okay. Or it might even be four different names, because it was, I think it was Home Farm for a bit, and then it was Dairy Farm.
Okay.
No, not Home Farm, it was Village Farm.
Right.
Then Dairy Farm, and then Grange Farm. And I think, in a typical RSPB sort of, I don't want to say, it is corporate, really. so, yes, this is going to be the farm that
embrace
gives hope
it
for wildlife, yeah.
So before the RSPB took it on in the millennium, what was the farm like? What did it look like then? Obviously, you weren't here then.
No.
But from what you know of those, what you hear of those days.
It was a typical family-run farm. So it was owned by, there was a father and his sons weren't too interested in it anymore, which is why they sold the farm. As you walk into the yard, you'd immediately see more barns full of more machinery because we're contracted now, so that's a big change. And then as you go out onto the farm, you would see lots of wheat that would be grown first, second, third.
Yeah.
There's one field that had six
years
of wheat. But there was the chemicals to deal with the weeds easily, and that was a profitable crop, and you'd be paid more money for the crops that you produced. So that made sense. And then you'd have, on the rest of the farm, it would be all seed rape, which again had the chemical warfare to combat any problems that may come in its way of improving the yield. There was some conservation measures around the farm. There was one sort of 50-metre, 2-metre wide grass margin, and there are a few gappy hedges. There was still the lovely stream running through it that there is now. And there was a very nice open pond at the top of the farm, which actually we're now having to work hard to keep it open and keep it as good quality as it was there. The pastures around the farm have always been there because the wife of the farmer had horses. That was kind of typical of farmland in this area, to be honest. Two crops, little tiny bit of conservation, but on the original surveys that were done here, you would struggle to find birds.
And is that partly why the RSPB were interested in it?
Yeah, they wanted to pick something that was didn't have much conservation, a real blank canvas to work from. I mean, the soil was as heavy as it is now to work in, or as baked as it is now this time of year. But the RSPB they wanted to go for something that would challenge the agronomy, or their agronomy a little bit as well, which is why we picked this place.
And what were the key aims from day one? And perhaps are they similar today, or have you got new aims today, new sort of objectives with what you're trying to achieve here?
They've evolved, I think, is probably the best way of describing it. So we bought the place. We knew what birds would probably need to survive, and we coined it as in the big three. So they need winter food, summer food, and breeding habitat.
Yeah.
We wanted to put that in place and show how much of a difference that could make to wildlife on the farm, particularly birds, because RSPB.
Yeah.
And then as time progressed, the big three evolved, which then actually consequently formed the Farm Wildlife Package and Countryside Stewardship. That evolved to wanting to provide a home for all nature, which is developed on the big three to having wet features and then field boundaries and really looking at what's on the farm and at what difference you can make. It was a demonstration farm, basically. We wanted to use that to externally say, look, you can have that diversity on the farm. We've got the monitoring to show it. But also as a really good internal learning source. We had more farm advisors then than we do now, actually, but it's much easier to go out on a farm confidently and talk with the farmer about what he can do if you've got a bit of a blueprint here, so you know the difficulties farmers go through as well.
Absolutely.
To get the cropping right, let alone getting all the conservation right.
Yeah. And I assume that's why it was so important at the time, also now, for the RSPB to have a working farm.
Yeah. It gives credibility to the advice you're giving at the end of the day.
Yeah.
It makes a big difference if someone goes on a farm trying to advise a farmer on what they're doing on the land, if they actually appear to have the background knowledge in farming. Mm. People knew we knew about birds, but it's how that it sort of goes back to the fact that the farmland has a dual purpose and making sure it satisfies that dual purpose.
Do you reckon lots of people know that this place exists, that the RSPB have a working farm?
I think more so now it's quite interesting that you still do get people 20 years on saying, well, you have a farm.
Yeah.
But they wanted to keep it quite quiet in a way for the first few years. Because when we bought the place, you wanted to get a baseline of wildlife. And they surveyed all sorts. They even went and surveyed fungi, amphibia, all sorts. And they had quite a lot of people. As soon as they found out about it, they were very interesting and wanted to come on the farm. And then they say, oh, it looks pretty normal to me. Where's the wildlife stuff? And then lost interest. So they wanted to keep it quiet for a little while. And then when we've made the habitat, or the amendments to the farm management, then make it more well known.
Take me through your cropping and your management style.
Okay. So cropping's diversified an awful lot. We've gone from having two crops to having, we only grow first wheats.
Yeah.
And then it's still dominated by cereals. So we have winter barley, spring barley we didn't actually bring in until 2015, I think.
Okay.
Mainly due to black grass issues, mm-hmm. but skylarks and a lot of birds prefer it, so that's good for us. Mm-hmm. Winter beans features quite a lot in the rotation. There's quite a lot of it out on the farm this year. Millet is grown as well, and then of course oilseed rape. We're looking into potentially growing canary grass.
Okay.
As well as another niche crop along with millet, but that will hold off till next year.
Mm-hmm.
We have tried linseed, but it just didn't work, so we'll never try that again. That was a nightmare. But yeah, it's working on the principle of just, we look at what the soil is, what it needs. If it's a little bit compacted before cultivating it, we'll try putting oilseed rape in, so you've got that big tap root. We haven't got a fixed rotation. It's more,
yeah.
We plan for the next few years and say, okay, so this is what we want to aim for. This is when we want to grow wheat, which is the most profitable crop. What do we need to put in place before?
There is room to adapt within that.
Yeah.
Mm. And you're a conventional farm, in inverted commas.
Yeah.
Whatever a conventional farm is. It's been in the news a lot recently. The spray arsenal, as it might be referred to, is being rapidly reduced with an increasing number of products being banned.
Mm-hmm.
Take me through your spraying program and your policy on spraying. There are several farmers who I could name by name, but I'm not going to, who have, for example, completely banned insecticides from their spray policy, and are moving towards a sort of mixed, taking say inspiration from the organic movement. Mm-hmm. But also inspiration from other farmers and doing what's best for them. What's your policy here?
You've kind of described our policy quite well, actually. We haven't used insecticides this year, and we won't do unless we really, really need to. That's evolved from in previous years. We haven't used insecticides when insects have become an important food source for birds. It's just not going to help a yellowhammer finding food for its chicks if you killed it all, basically. So that's always been a no-brainer for us. We have always been careful. I mean, now you're enforced to, but we've always used ferric phosphate
mm-hmm.
as our molluscicide and put that down the spout with the drill and left that. That's not a spray, but another sort of means of pest control. The herbicides we use, I mean, you're right, it is sort of, we've taken flavours from organic farming and tried to just minimise what we're doing. So not just using herbicides out the can as our main means of control, otherwise black grass would have a wonderful time and we wouldn't ever be able to grow winter wheat. So we delay our cropping, our winter wheat, or drilling. Our winter wheat wasn't drilled till about mid-November this year.
Okay.
It was a really dry autumn, so the black grass just wasn't germinating and there was no point in drilling it until we got a flush of it so we could clean up the seed bed, and the winter wheat, fingers crossed, still looks quite clean now.
Mm-hmm. Does the RSPB have a position on glyphosate? Do they purposefully stand on the fence?
Yeah, I think the latter.
It's too dangerous to have a position.
Yeah, it's really useful for our policy team here to see how we use it responsibly. If you're putting down fire sprays of glyphosate throughout the winter where it's not quite enough to kill off your black grass or what weeds you've got before spraying spring barley, that's doing a really good job of building up resistance. And it's just a silly idea to do that. Again, if you're using glyphosate as your only tool of controlling weeds you don't want, then you're just asking for resistance, as well as if you use antibiotics for every kind of ailment that you had in your body. That's how I look at it. Yeah, it's just a case of using other things at the same time.
I want to talk about surveying and gathering general biodiversity data. Because I imagine that you do a significant amount here in terms of gathering data. What baseline are you working to, and what changes have you seen over since that baseline began?
So we have surveys done yearly on birds over winter, breeding birds in the summer, both focusing on farmland bird species. And then every year we do butterflies via the UK Butterfly Monitoring Scheme. And since 2013, we've also had surveys done every year on bumblebees. On the butterflies and birds, we can compare them. We've sort of got a Hope Farm Index that we create a sort of a measure of change since day dot, which is 2000, when we bought the place. And then we compare that to the rate of change on the UK breeding birds. We can't do that for wintering birds because there isn't a winter farmland bird index for the UK. Well, that'd be quite interesting. They've got a winter BBS set up, so it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that. And the butterflies, we can enrol that as part of a UK scheme, and we can compare that as well to the change in butterflies year on year. But since we bought the farm, I think the changes that the things that have made the biggest difference has been the countryside stewardship measures that we've put in place, because you can see from sort of 2007 onwards, there's the graphs up there actually, but the birds, both wintering and summer, and have sort of increased massively. They were increasing slowly, but since we had the funding and could put in a lot more, they've made a real difference. And we've managed to increase our breeding farmland bird index by about, it was 226% last year, the year before last, slightly down last year, but maintain around the sort of 1.5 to 2.5 times more breeding birds. Wintering birds stay around between sort of 15 and 17 times more than they used to. So the wintering birds have made a massive change. And that's simply from the changes in making sure they've got winter food available to them. Butterflies, the biggest differences we found are a result of having the wildflower margins in place. It's quite interesting now that we are maintaining a stable equilibrium, that changes are mostly sort of weather dependent, or last year we had more supplementary feeding of more oilseed rape on the ground. Linnet numbers are the highest they've ever been. And you can, whereas the winter bird seed mixes didn't grow quite so well, so although we had a cereal component in the winter bird seed mix, in the supplementary food even, yellowhammers hadn't done quite as well as they have in previous winters.
What about flagship species mentioned earlier? We weren't recording, but I mentioned that you've one of your barn owl boxes, you've got a recent egg, which in a box that hasn't been used for a while. Tell me about some of those flagship species.
I think you have the farmland birds that you can quite easily cater for and increase their numbers. And then you've got the ones that are really niche and really difficult. And when you get those on the farm, it's like, oh, golden moment, of which the barn owls is one, because we do have a few grass meadows around, but it's not nearly as many as there used to be. So to have them in the barn owl box, in the barn, up the top's quite special for us. You then go to the simpler species to cater for, which are sort of the yellowhammers, the linnets, the skylarks. Those numbers have just skyrocketed because they're really quite simple. If you have skylark plots and insect food in the summer, you're going to have those sorted. Yeah. Yellowhammers, if you have good hedges and you have winter food available and summer food, going to have yellowhammers, same as linnets. You then go to the things we've had quite good successes with are lapwings. For those, our cropping has actually played just as much of a factor in their breeding success as making sure that there's insect food available for them in the summer. So having the winter beans on the farm means that we've got quite a good vegetation structure around their breeding time. And then we've got a big lapwing plot in the middle of our winter bean field for them as well. Having a bit of straw on top of the ground as well actually means that they can sort of gather up and make a albeit very messy, but they can make some sort of nest. Turtle doves are a bit of a sore point for us, actually. Probably being down in Essex, you're more in turtle dove territory, but we're right on the edge of their population expanse, and they have retracted from here in recent years, and you only really tend to see them on reserves mostly, like Falmouth have a few. I know some farms over the way, about 5 miles away from here, have had turtle doves on, but
when we look on with jealousy,
we do slightly because we I was chatting to you when we weren't recording. We have, as part of a research program, 12 different plots that we've put in place this year to really experiment with getting that right vegetation and the right structure for them. We've got water sources for them, we've got big scrubby hedges next to a bit of woodland, branches overhanging in the streams and ponds for them to sit on and feed, but we haven't had a territory since 2011.
Yeah.
It's really frustrating, but I hope that if we, it would only take one to fly by and think and find that the south end of our farm, that should be perfect territory for them.
Obviously, we're quite far away from detail yet, but the upcoming ELMS, Environmental Land Management Contracts, what are your thoughts on those as an idea? Is it a good move forward? Are they a good idea?
I think change is really important. Like, if you go back, we had ELS, which got a lot of farmers involved, but it was very easy for farmers to get paid for not making a massive difference to wildlife on the farm. But it was great that they were involved. And then the scheme has evolved to improve in terms of what it can do for wildlife on the farm. The scheme can be used, as we've shown here, to really make a difference. But they've lost all the farmers along the way. I think it's really good that with the new ELMS plans and trials and everything, they're really listening to the fact that the bureaucracy around the scheme, the fact that it is so prescriptive, plus the inspections that and the lack of payments for 1, 2, 3 years is a huge deterrent for farmers, because it can destabilise a business and cause a lot of stress for a farmer when it's already a very stressful business. If it does move the way that they're saying it is, in that a farmer can come up with a plan that suits their farm, which will need a lot of advice to make it effective, but if it is coupled with the advice and a simpler mechanism with a better system for dealing with all these applications, it's really exciting for what a difference it could make in the wider landscape.
Right, we're going to try the 1 minute soapbox.
Okay.
So listeners, this gives guests an opportunity to talk about a subject of their choice. It could be anything at all for 1 minute. I'm just putting up the timer for Georgie. Georgie, do you know what you're going to be talking about?
I want to talk about different ways that farmers can and do get involved with conservation on their farm.
Perfect. Okay, so you've got 1 minute. Your time starts now.
Okay, so when you think of conservation and providing a habitat for wildlife on farmland, it's very easy to get constrained in countryside stewardship, which is a really good way of funding farmers to make sure that they provide lots of good habitat on farmland. But I think it's quite important to recognise that there are other ways beyond that that farmers can get involved. That's whether it's engaging the public on wildlife you can have on the farm, sharing with other farmers what they're doing and how they're doing it, which makes the hurdles for other farmers to get involved much simpler, or whether it's just doing little bits of voluntary conservation management on their own farm. It's quite an interesting statistic that from nearly every farm could take 5% of its area. That's gone.
That's 1 minute.
No.
Finish
can
the
I
thought.
Start again?
Finish the thought.
Oh, dear. I say, okay. Wow. That is the biggest, fastest minute ever. Okay, I'll round it up quickly. I think any farmer could, there is a statistic that any farmer could take 5% of their land out of cropping and they wouldn't be worse off. And I think if any if every farmer thought about the 5% of their land that they could take out, and if they either left it fallow for arable plants, left it to tussocky grass margins, or even if they could get it right, take the time and put down a corner of their field to wildlife flowers, that sort of gets the wheel going and seeing what wildlife, what a difference that can make for wildlife on the farm. And I think making that step to how exciting the farm can be for biodiversity is really important.
Brilliant, that's super. Thank you so much for speaking to me. Can we have a bit of a wander around as well?
I think we should.
Having come up here. And the sun is coming out again. I feel like I've had a grey haze which has been following me around for the last few days wherever I've been. It's been bright sunshine everywhere else. But the sun's come out, so let's go and have a wander around.
That's meant to be a warm morning. It'll be good.
How much of the farm is accessible to the public?
So where we're walking along now, this is a public footpath that runs between Knapwell and Ellsworth, Ellsworth is a decent sized village. Knapwell is pretty much a road with a few houses along it. And then we've also, so that's sort of going east to west of the farm. Then there's also a public footpath that goes from north to south of the farm as well, right up to Cairnbourne.
Okay.
And whilst it doesn't run like a RSPB nature reserve, in that we make it a real big visitor experience, we do, I'd say we get about 15 people a day we would see walking along here.
Okay.
Which is quite nice, and they do, it's actually lovely when we stop and I'll have a chat if we get to know the locals.
Yeah, I was going to say, they become regulars.
Yeah, there's quite a few regulars. I know there's this one guy with a Rhodesian Ridgeback that's very friendly. And wanders along, and then there's another lady who is actually a local artist, and she has painted pictures of lapwings and stuff like that and some landscapes around here, who's fantastic to chat to. So you get, it's much more on a more farm than nature reserve scale.
And you've got quite a lot of these information boards around about the place. Have they been sort of integrated into the farm since the early beginnings?
No, actually, that was the legacy of our last farm manager, Ian Dillon. He put them in because the locals and we were talking to them, and they sort of said, "Well, if you hadn't have told me, I wouldn't know this is an RSPB farm."
Mm.
And whilst we want it to be a commercial farm and seen as a normal farm, it is still useful for people to actually see that it is owned by the RSPB.
Mm-hmm.
There are also these signs here that just to remind people, because that looks like quite a nice grass track right next to this track here. But actually, that's a wildflower margin. It's quite a lot of oxeye daisies getting ready to go.
Yeah, so currently, we're walking along the track to our left. We have a very established wide hedgerow running into the track, then running into a... What width is this margin?
That's 6 metres. It's probably a little bit bigger than six, but to be on the safe side, we let them be a little bit larger.
And then you run it along both sides of the field, so you've got that connectivity moving through as well.
Yes. The one actually running down the north-south side along that track, that is to be established and drilled. The soil's warm enough, but as soon as it's wet enough, that'll be established with a pollen and nectar margin, as that was getting a little tired. But there's around every field on the farm, there is some sort of margin. And I think around every field but one, which is the overwinter stubble we walk past, there is some sort of wildflower margin. And then as we're walking along here, we'll get to, there's a winter bird seed mix, which is getting a bit tired, but it's coming into a new use of its own now in some way.
So what's next for you? I can see you potentially be here for several years ahead, hopefully.
Yeah, I hope so.
But where do you see your career heading?
Oh, I don't know, really.
Would you move, say, back into, I don't know, working for Wildlife Trust, or more of a... again, conventional, in inverted commas, conservation career?
Can you see yourself sort of sitting in ag?
Oh no, it's got to sit in agriculture. I think last year, a few months ago, before my old boss suggested that I took on farm manager's role, he was like, come on, what's your plan? Where do you want to go? And I was like, I don't want to go anywhere. And that's still kind of the case now, really. I'm quite happy working here. But I go home and I badger Dad and give him some ideas for what to do on the farm at home.
Yeah.
Like, we're in Essex, so we've got an area put aside for turtle doves, and we had a winter bird seed mix. And I'd love to be more involved in the farm as he gets a bit older.
Mm.
As with my brother, so that works quite well.
Okay. we're now standing by an area that has been recently cultivated.
Yeah, that was.
But isn't. This is something else going in here. What's going in here?
This is going to be drilled with a winter bird seed mix.
Okay.
I really hope we get some rain, because you can probably see this was cultivated. It was dissed a few months ago and then power harrowed a couple of weeks ago now, and then rolled last week. And where we just haven't had the rain, it's just formed these heavy clods. It's been a conservation area for a while, so it's not like it's had lots of traffic on it.
Yeah.
We just need some good rain to break it up, really.
This is the issue with clay, isn't it? That is solid as solid.
It's not breaking up. We've got a field of rocks at the moment.
Georgie Bray showing me round the RSVB's Hope Farm in Cambridgeshire. Next time, I'll be speaking to a couple of farmers who also hold conservation at the heart of their ethos, and that is the Barker boys, Patrick and Brian Barker from Suffolk. The Barker's farm is a leaf demonstration farm, as well as a strategic farm for the Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board. So I hope you can join me then. In the meantime, if you've enjoyed this episode, please do subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and you can check out all previous episodes on thinkingcountry.com. I'll see you next time.